This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Germany and Italy man the battle stations ahead of tomorrow's EU summit.
And will Best Buy go private to stay in business? Hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update for Wednesday, June 27th. We're also going to go in-depth look at what happens to all the work that's been done, and it's a tremendous amount of work, all the changes already in place if the Supreme Court throws out the health reform law.
And also from the political or Washington front, the big line in the Obama campaign this week is that Mitt Romney is a pioneer in the outsourcing of jobs. We're going to check in on whether that statement is correct. It's all coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
European leaders come together in Brussels tomorrow to supposedly collaborate on the EU's debt problems. But this morning it's shaping up more like a standoff. Germany and Italy, in particular, are staking out opposite ends of some key issues. Marketplace's Stephen Beard joins me now from London. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Jeff.
So German Chancellor Angela Merkel is committing herself to more and more intractable negotiating position. Now she basically said, what, Eurobonds over my dead body or something like that, right?
Yes, unusually vivid language for a modern German leader. Merkel was speaking to a group of her lawmakers yesterday, and she said, Eurobonds, not as long as I live. And one of the lawmakers present shouted, then we wish you a very long life.
Why is Germany so fearful of Eurobonds? Basically, using the full credit of Europe, right, to raise money for the struggling members of the EU.
That's right. I mean, the Germans don't like it because they don't want to sign a blank check for the Greeks, the Spaniards and the Italians. They know that they are the richest people in the Eurozone, and the Germans, that is. And they fear that if they join this so-called debt union, if they join in an arrangement standing behind the debts of all the other countries, they will end up footing the bill if those other weaker countries default.
Everybody's throwing up signals. Meanwhile, we've got the Italian prime minister saying basically he will not get up from his seat at the summit until he gets what he wants. How are they going to bridge this gap?
Well, something must come out of this summit. There will probably be an agreement to allow the bailout fund to buy Eurozone government bonds directly to take some of the pressure off Italy and Spain. But will analysts and market watchers be impressed? Here's Simon Tilford of the Centre for European Reform.
The question is, will that be enough to reassure investors to actually calm the markets? And I think the answer to that is almost certainly no.
This summit is the 19th Eurozone Leaders Summit designed to finally crack the debt crisis. Tilford says there will very likely be a 20th, 21st, 22nd and 23rd.
Stephen Beard, live in London. Thank you very much.
Okay, Jeff.
The 15-month uprising in Syria has been especially worrisome for Turkey, which shares a border. Now more than ever, after Syria shot down a Turkish military plane on Friday. The BBC's Jonathan Head joins us now from Istanbul with the latest. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, how has the shooting down of this Turkish plane changed the situation there with Syria?
Well, it certainly made the Turkish government much more assertive in its policy. It says it will respond more aggressively in future to any perceived Syrian threat. But I think Turkey will still be cautious. It's still very worried about its armed forces getting entangled in the growing civil war in Syria. It doesn't want to be put out up front ahead of everyone else. I think it will only act aggressively against Syria for all of its anger about the plane if it has substantial international backing, and crucially from the United States.
Now, some of the countries like Russia that have been so far reluctant to put economic sanctions on Syria or get involved in this conflict are doing that in part because they have strong economic ties to Syria. What about Turkey?
Turkey was building a very successful economic relationship with Syria until the conflict started there. It was very important in particular for towns down on the border. It really benefited from Syrian tourists coming over, from trade in manufactured goods. It had rocketed up by 10 times over the last decade to more than $2 billion. That has been hit very hard by not just the plunge in relations, but by the chaos there as well. Turkish truckers who use Syria as a route to get to the rest of the Middle East can't go now because it's too dangerous. And trade has plunged by about 60% at the beginning of this year. In overall terms, it's not a significant amount of trade for Turkey because it's got much bigger trade with the European Union and other countries. But for those areas down on the border, it's been a very big blow indeed.
The BBC's Jonathan Head in Istanbul. Thanks very much.
Good to talk to you.
The consumer electronics giant Best Buy wants to avoid the fate of its former rival Circuit City, which liquidated back in 2009.
So the company's founder and largest shareholder, Richard Schultz, is reportedly considering taking the company private and giving it a makeover. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
It's been a rough year for Best Buy. Sales are off, and the chief executive resigned in March after hiding an affair with a subordinate. The company's stock price has dropped almost 40%. Michael Pachter, a research analyst at Wedbush Securities, says Best Buy can't compete for internet shoppers.
Any price-conscious, tech-savvy consumer who has a smartphone is able to use Best Buy as a showroom and comparison shop instantly. And when they do comparison shop for big-ticket items like televisions, they will always find that those TVs are cheaper somewhere else.
Schultz, who owns about 20% of Best Buy, isn't commenting, but news reports say he wants to take the company private in order to drastically downsize stores and streamline the merchandise. But analyst Pachter is skeptical.
It'll take them, 10 years to get out of the leases that they have to open up new stores, and they don't have 10 years.
Pachter doesn't hold out much hope for Best Buy's future.
Best Buy is the blockbuster of, this decade.
In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Now to the presidential campaign, which has returned to the issue of private equity and the outsourcing of jobs. President Obama has latched onto a Washington Post report says that private equity firm Bain Capital, which Mitt Romney used to run, helped pioneer the outsourcing of jobs. Here's President Obama speaking a few days ago.
Let me tell you, Tampa, we do not need an outsourcing pioneer in the Oval Office. We need a president who will fight for American jobs and fight for American manufacturing. That's what my plan will do.
Well, let's get some analysis now from Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So, Chris, is it true? Was Romney a pioneer in outsourcing?
Yes, it's absolutely true, Jeremy. And this but is very important. It was part of the business scene of the time. There are lots of pioneers. Let's give a little bit of context here. U.S. business, it was having its clock cleaned by Japanese competitors, German competitors, British competitors. And so people like Romney were coming in, taking over companies, adding on a lot of debt, and looking for efficiency. So what was the mantra? Well, what is our core competency? What is our business? Outsource everything else.
Well, the Romney campaign, though, has come back and said there's a big difference between outsourcing and offshoring, and that distinction was not made in this original story in The Washington Post.
Okay, so the motivation is essentially the same, right? Between when you outsource or you go offshore. The big distinction is offshore is you're going overseas. So the seminal moment with offshoring was Y2K. Remember Y2K when the computers were going to come down? And a lot of the computer programming was done in India because they had the expertise. And all of a sudden, business woke up and said, hey, if we can be doing computer programming overseas in India, what about call centers? What about accounting? So in a sense, they're two sides of the same coin. But outsourcing, which is the bigger topic, is you go to a company that has a competency that you don't want to have. You pay them to do your payroll, to do your IT. Offshoring is you do that overseas.
Well, politics aside, from a business perspective, Chris, was there any way to escape this outsourcing trend at U.S. companies back in the 80s?
No. What was the mantra? We live in this global economy. Business was restructuring to be more productive, to be more efficient. And so this was part of the drive toward higher productivity, which we saw in the 1990s, and also taking advantage of a lot of the innovations coming out of Silicon Valley with information technologies. It was part of globalization, part of increasing productivity, part of becoming a more competitive nation.
Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
The price of oil is falling today, and it's down about 25% over recent months. Those falling oil prices are good for our pocketbooks. They're also arguably good for American foreign policy. Here to flesh out that angle is Samuel Chisick with KBC Energy Economics in London. Hello.
Pleasure.
What are the key forces that are pushing oil prices down right now?
Well, I mean, you know, it's really the crisis of sentiment right now and the worries about the impact on demand rather than supply problems. You know, kind of demand destruction results in the U.S. and questions over whether China might actually have a hard landing after all.
And we have Saudi Arabia doing their part as well to hold prices down, yes?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if there is no supply shortage, basically, you know, we see a very well-supplied situation, not only because of Saudi Arabia. Iraq is producing much more than previously. Nigeria is stable. And, of course, Libya is back pretty much to levels close to where it was before the whole uprising. So it's a good situation on the supply side.
And why is the falling price of oil especially tough on Iran?
Well, I mean, we see the sanctions against Iran, the, sort of the result of previous packages, but also, of course, of the upcoming EU embargo and tightening of U.S. sanctions, which will all happen sort of at the end of June and early July. Right now, a lot of clients, former clients of Iran, sort of buying their crude, are just stepping away. They can't touch Iranian crude, particularly the European Union members, but also a lot of Asian clients, actually, because of the rather wide sanctions for making it hard to transfer money, making it hard to just, you know, insure any dealings with Iran, etc. So we see a lot of former buyers stepping away, and Iranian exports are falling. They might actually have halved by now.
Samuel Chisick with KBC Energy Economics in London. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Well, while we're in London, Jeff, there's the iconic clock tower known as Big Ben. Actually, one of the bells in the tower is named Big Ben, but everybody calls it Big Ben anyway. Mm-hmm. Well, now you might want to start calling it Big Beth. It is being renamed Elizabeth Tower to mark Queen Elizabeth's 60th year on the throne.
A sex change for Big Ben.
You could put it that way. And I guess that means also that this little piece of Hollywood history from National Lampoon's European Vacation is about to become a relic as well.
Hey, look, kids. There's Big Ben and there's Parliament.
There it is, there it is, there it is.
Kids. We know Big Ben.
Parliament.
The great Chevy Chase.
A relic and a classic.
Sad news now. Filmmaker and screenwriter Nora Ephron has passed away. She left a legacy of romantic comedy classics like Sleepless in Seattle and When Harry Met Sally. She redefined the genre, maybe even invented it.
Here to talk with us about the rise and maybe the fall of the romantic comedy is Scott Beggs. He's managing editor of Film School Rejects. Hello, Scott.
Thanks for having me.
Sure thing. Tell us what Nora Ephron did to pioneer the rom-com genre.
You know, it's interesting to view her as a pioneer because a lot of her story elements in both the writing and her directing come from classics. Sleepless in Seattle uses An Affair to Remember as a reference point. Mm-hmm. You've Got Mail is a remake of the great Margaret Sullivan, Jimmy Stewart film, The Shop Around the Corner.
It's kind of a remake of Sleepless in Seattle, actually, when you think about it.
Yeah, kind of. There's a lot of classic tropes involved in what she was doing. But what surprised everyone about When Harry Met Sally was how frank it was, especially about sex. And I think because of that and because of the way that she twisted kind of classic romantic comedy ideas, the impact that Ephron had as a pioneer in the modern era of romantic comedies was simply recapturing the old magic of seeing two complex people who we as an audience desperately want to see fall in love.
Do you think that she would have liked what the romantic comedy became? I mean, there are a lot of good ones out there, but there are also there's also Gigli and, you know, a number of other that probably aren't quite as proud moments for film.
You know, I'm not sure. And I haven't seen her speak on the subject at all, but she was pretty famously direct and famously caustic. She's a very funny woman. And I know that she valued storytelling and very humane characters. So I think that there are a lot of examples of romantic comedies out there born from her tradition that she probably would not have been a big fan of.
Yeah, in this age of, you know, four movies a year with Reese Witherspoon and Sarah Jessica Parker, what has happened to the romantic comedy?
A couple of things. I think part of it is that there are just so many that are made now that it's harder to find the diamonds in the rough, but they're there. I think from the 70s through the 90s, there were something like 60 major romantic comedies made. And then from the 2000s on, in just 12 years, we've seen something like 250. So it's a larger pot. But you've also got movies like Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist or Forgetting Sarah Marshall, Love Actually, Going the Distance. These are all good examples of the genre. And there are others, of course, but there's also just a much larger list of hollow-feeling movies that have all of the right elements there, all of the formulas there, but they don't have the characters or the heart.
What did you learn from her?
You know, I think that I learned from her what I gained from her films is what most people did, that there should be a focus on creating and crafting interesting characters that find that balance between who we are and who we wish we could be. And I think that's what made a lot of her movies infinitely rewatchable.
Scott Beggs is the managing editor of Film School Rejects. Very good to talk with you, Scott. Thank you.
It's my pleasure.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, says the U.S. is not doing a good job retraining unemployed workers, at least compared with other industrialized nations.
Well, let's assume the OECD is right, that the U.S. could do a better job at retraining. Would that bring down the unemployment rate? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that story.
Let's start with two job seekers I met at the unemployment office here in Portland, Oregon. Pam Seidel lost her job working in a warehouse last year. With $250 a week on unemployment, she says there's no money left to pay for trade school or community college. So she's out there with just her high school diploma.
There's a lot of people out there looking for work. It's horrible.
Sitting at the next table is Elvia Gonzalez. She's a CNA, a certified nursing assistant. She saved up before losing her job.
I'm going to come back to school and get training in the same profession I have right now. I'm not worried. I know I'm going to have a job.
It's a good bet. Any additional certificate Gonzalez gets in elder care, say, or rehab, will give her an edge. Which brings us to the nub of the problem, says labor economist Heidi Shearholtz at the Economic Policy Institute. There are nearly four job seekers competing for every available job right now.
So training may help certain individuals, but it is not going to solve the unemployment problem. Because what you'll have then is more highly trained workers competing for the same very, very scarce jobs.
Many economists and industry groups disagree. They say more Americans would be able to find jobs if only they had more job skills, better math and science, computer training to work with electronic medical records or robotics. Gardner Carrick of the Manufacturing Institute says 600,000 jobs are vacant because employers can't find qualified workers.
Because they can't fill current jobs, they can't take new orders, so they can't create new jobs.
Shearholtz counters that even if every company could miraculously find all the skilled workers they needed, it wouldn't dent the unemployment rate much. She does think we should invest more to retrain the unemployed. It'll help both workers and the companies that hire them. She just doesn't think it'll do much to jumpstart economic growth or job creation. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Well, Jeremy, tomorrow is it. And I don't even need to say what it is, do I? I
think we all know what I'm talking about. Waiting for that Supreme Court decision.
It's either a national holiday or a day that will live in infamy, depending on where you stand on the health reform law. Whatever the Supreme Court decides, a tremendous amount of the new law has already been implemented. According to some reading I was doing this morning, it's essentially unprecedented in that respect to potentially have a law thrown out when so much has already unfolded. Hmm. To talk about what's in place and what might happen to all of that, we've got Sarah Collins. She's a vice president of affordable health insurance at the Commonwealth Fund. Sarah, thanks for being here.
Nice to talk to you.
Insurance companies have already made a lot of changes since the law was passed, and let's just take a few of these one by one. They can't exclude people, for example, right now with pre-existing conditions. What happens if that requirement goes away?
Well, actually, it will be applicable to everybody starting in 2014. This is a hugely important provision. We know from our insurance surveys at the Commonwealth Fund that more than 30% of people who said they tried to buy a health plan in the last 3 years didn't end up buying a plan because they were either turned down, charged a higher price, or had a condition excluded because of their condition. The other aspect of the law that addresses people who are uninsured, who have pre-existing health problems, are the pre-existing condition insurance plans that are available in all 50 states right now. About 62,000 people have enrolled in these plans since the plans were rolled out. So this is also a hugely important bridge provision in the law that will get people with pre-existing conditions through this period where we're waiting for the major reforms to start in 2014.
Under the law, parents can now keep their kids up to age 25 on their policies. And we've heard some large insurance companies say that regardless of what the Supreme Court decides, they plan to keep that as a part of their business. Why would they want to keep it?
This has been just an enormous benefit for young adults. Insurance companies are in compliance with this provision. States across the country have written this into their insurance laws or their regulations. And so this feels like a provision that's here to stay. It's a relatively inexpensive thing for employers to do. It does not increase premiums. This is a young and healthy population. Mm-hmm. And so this is now a benefit for employers, and you would expect it to continue.
Finally, states and the federal government have put in tremendous energy designing these health insurance exchanges, which are supposed to improve the access and the prices for individuals shopping for plans. Could all that work have been for nothing?
So this train is certainly well out of the station in terms of both states and also the federal government. And we would expect to see that continue under various scenarios if things change. Many states are already so well along. And the federal financing is obviously going to be very important. So about $500 billion in federal tax credits will flow through the exchanges for people. It's very important that states have these federal subsidies to help their residents gain affordable insurance coverage options.
Sarah Collins with the Commonwealth Fund. It's going to be a wild couple of days for you, whatever happens. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
A federal appeals court has ruled that the Environmental Protection Agency can regulate greenhouse gas emissions. That ruling is seen as a win for environmentalists and a loss for car makers, power plants, and oil companies. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
The EPA's authority to limit global warming emissions goes back to a Supreme Court ruling from 2007. It's complicated. But the upshot is lots of people don't like it. Groups of farmers, miners, truckers, home builders, herders, and drillers all challenged it in federal court and lost. Business professor Jay Apt at Carnegie Mellon says the EPA now has a green light to regulate tailpipe and power plant emissions.
The ruling clears the way for both mobile sources and the stationary sources.
Coal interests have particular reason to be worried. Their product spits out twice the carbon of natural gas, which also happens to be cheaper in many places. Andy Byers is with a consulting and construction firm, Black & Veatch.
In addition to the market advantage the gas has now, this action would make it even more difficult for coal-fired power plants.
He figures in the coming decade, natural gas will push aside coal as the king of power generation. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
So, Jeff, I'm still trying to figure out if this weekend or next weekend is the holiday weekend because the 4th of July this year falls on a Wednesday.
I'm going to party either way.
All right, both times for you. Well, either way, Independence Day is right around the corner, and to celebrate, we are going to spend this week's Money Matters segment talking about the political process and how Americans are spending money when it comes to politics. Tess Vigeland is the host of our consumer finance show, Marketplace Money, and she joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, Tess, we always hear that the economy is the big issue for voters, but how much of that is the overall economy and how much of it is just personal finances?
Well, of course, when you look at the macro economy, everything that happens there certainly affects our wallets and our bank accounts, our personal economies. But this is definitely an indicator for us when we're choosing candidates. Bankrate.com did a survey recently that found 6 in 10 Americans say their personal financial situation is an important factor in their vote this year. In fact, some said it was the most important factor. But here's a kicker, Jeremy. Half of those same respondents said no matter who wins, it's probably not going to help their finances.
So does that mean people are not getting involved in campaigns to try to at least influence the process and get the person in power that might help their finances? Or what are they doing?
Well, no. You know, the recent numbers we have on that are back from 2009 from the Pew Research Center. And it showed that we are engaged. In fact, the more money you have, the more engaged you are in the political process. Hmm. And here's another indicator, you know, how many of us are volunteering our time free of charge for the campaigns. Well, the federal government says about 3.4 million of us are. So we are staying somewhat involved with both our money and our time.
But of course, this year is different. We've got these big super PACs, these big money donors that can go and give $1 million or whatever
right.
to support their favorite candidate. Is that keeping ordinary people out of the process at all? Do we know?
Well, no. You know, the recent numbers we have on that are back from 2009 from the Pew Research Center. And it showed that contributions from us to candidates for Senate, House, and the presidential campaign topped $363 million. And that was just in the first quarter. So we are not shying away from opening up our wallets for the politicians that we are giving low ratings to.
But of course, Tess, you and I are not giving money to anybody because that's our duty as journalists.
Of course not.
Tess Vigeland, host of Marketplace Money, thanks as always.
Thanks, Jeremy.
So you've heard of Instagram, the photo app that Facebook bought for $1 billion. Angry Birds has made bundles of cash, and apparently they're turning it into a movie. Well, today, thousands of would-be app makers are heading to Google's developers conference. It's called Google I.O. in San Francisco. Here's Queena Kim with a report.
Miguel Angel Diaz is the founder of Red Karaoke. He's launching a new version of a sing-along app at Google I.O.
Stay tuned because I hope it will be rocking the Google I.O.
The free app is downloaded about 5,000 times a day. That's 5,000 people he hopes to convert to paying customers. He considers his app a success.
We think a great app is about 1 million daily users or higher.
Peter Farrago is VP of Marketing for Flurry, which tracks about 200,000 apps. For free apps, Farrago says active users are more important than downloads because most people stop using the average app after a month. Farrago says hits like Angry Birds are rare, but less popular apps might still find some backing. Richard Miner is with Google Ventures.
VCs aren't necessarily looking for that one-hit wonder.
Miner says they're looking for a strong team that can bring steady growth. In San Francisco, I'm Queena Kim for Marketplace.
So, Jeremy, you probably remember last week, who could forget, Microsoft introduced this thing called the Surface.
Oh, yeah, we talked about
it. Right, their tablet computer. And they're putting a big bet on this piece of hardware. Well, today, founder Bill Gates reminds us, this is sort of odd timing, that tablets are not the solution to everything. Hmm. He was talking to the Chronicle of Higher Education about giving tablets to students around the world.
Well, just giving people devices, that has a really terrible track record. You really have to change the curriculum and the teacher and those things.
So he goes on to say that tablets are great for reading stuff. They're not so great for writing, which is also a very important skill. For that, he recommends, he says, you really need, guess what? A good old-fashioned PC. Surprise, surprise.
How convenient.
You know, but Gates is speaking as a philanthropist these days for the most part. He can say whatever he wants. But you got to think Microsoft's corporate PR department might have liked just a quick check-in ahead of time for this interview.
Well, finally, Jeff, in Rhode Island, an obscure 1989 law has been repealed. It made it a crime for anyone in Rhode Island to lie on the internet about anything at all. Age, height, whatever. The head of the Rhode Island ACLU said the law made virtually the entire population of Rhode Island criminals.
I don't even live there, and I'm trying to think if I've ever lied on the internet in
Rhode
Island.
Oh, I'm sure you've never, ever sent an email that was wrong or anything like that.
I may even have done it while passing through Rhode Island, I do believe.
Well, in New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.